You are Locked On Dodgers, your daily Los Angeles Dodgers podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hey friends, this is Jeff. Just a quick note, the conversation you're about to hear, when I started it, I thought it was going to be about 25 or 30 minutes and it would be one episode. It ended up being about an hour, and so it's actually going to be the next two episodes, but I didn't realize that till partway through. So you're going to hear me talking to baseball writer extraordinaire Rob Nyer, and it will sound like I'm planning on being just one episode because that's what I was planning on. So enjoy the first half of this episode.
So I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team.
Hello, Dodger fans. Welcome to Locked On Dodgers, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, the number one local sports daily podcast network. Locked On, your team every day. This is the daily podcast covering the Los Angeles Dodgers, who you may remember recently won the World Series. Bring you the smart fans' perspective on our boys in blue. I am Jeff Snyder of Baseball Essential. My regular co-host, Vince Semperio of Chavez Ravine Fiends, is still off gallivanting about Atlanta after probably drowning his sorrows after watching his Raiders lose to the Falcons the other day. But, you know, that's football. Who cares? So instead, I have somebody much better today. My good friend Rob Nyer is here. Rob, how are you?
I'm well, and I'm even better because you described me as a good friend, not just a friend. So I'm very grateful for that.
Absolutely. Yeah, Rob Nyer is, if you are familiar with baseball writing, you're probably familiar with Rob. Rob wrote for ESPN for years, wrote for Fox for a while. Most recently, I guess most of your recent writing has been of the book variety, right?
Yes, that's true, and there's been just one since the Fox gig went away. But as you probably know, I have another one that'll be out in about a year and a half. So yeah, I'm busy, just not in the way that I used to be busy.
Yeah, well, I am excited to talk to you about your recent book and your upcoming book, and then just in general, a lot of your baseball content these days is you are the host of SaberCast with Rob Nyer, and That's kind of why I decided to ask you to come on the show. A question that you often ask your guests on that show, which is, what's your favorite way to consume baseball? And so that's going to be, I think, the bulk of our conversation. Mm-hmm. First, I want to remind our listeners to please subscribe to Locked On Dodgers wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, you can tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Dodgers. So, Rob, you and I've been a follower of your work since I started getting interested in the analytical side of baseball. Basically, I was kind of late to that, even though I'm about 10 years younger than you, I think. And you know, I hear people even my age and even younger than me saying they grew up reading Bill James. I was a full grown adult and more full grown than most adults ever get by the time I ever even heard of Bill James. And it was Moneyball was the book that got me into it. And once I read Moneyball and I loved it, I still haven't seen the movie, but I've read the book 8 or 9 times and I got really interested in that. And once you start getting interested in the analytical side of baseball, at that time, you know, the early 2000s, I guess, Rob Nyer was kind of the logical next step. If you wanted to read regular, schedule wise, frequently written topics on the analytical side of baseball. And so I started reading you, you know, it's been close to 20 years ago now, I guess. And then it's been about 5 or 6 years since you and I became friends. And I think we've been good friends for like 3 years now. So, you know, that's kind of,
well, I considered you a kindred spirit ever since our first, we met for either breakfast or coffee at that place in Phoenix that is no longer there. Well, they moved. But I could tell you we were kindred spirits.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you had coffee and I had breakfast because I don't drink coffee. But you picked the place and it was really good. And that's sad that it was, but so it still exists. It's just not in that location anymore.
They moved about 3 blocks away to a much larger space, which it's fine, but there was something really rustic about the old spot that I really liked.
It was a charming little place. Yeah. And yeah, we were both in Arizona for spring training. That was 2015. Actually, that was the same trip that I met Vince, my co-host on this podcast. I met him for the first time just a day or two before you and I first met in person. And then we've spent just a little time together. We've seen each other. I think that both of the other times that we've been in each other's physical presence was at Dodger Stadium. Once you happened to be at a game that I happened to be at. And so I came over and said hi, and yep. I was crouching next to your seat when Jock Peterson robbed a home run. You remember that?
I do.
Yeah. And then the other time we actually went to a game together, that was, I think, just 2019.
Cody Bellinger bobblehead night, right?
That's right. Cody Bellinger bobblehead night, which worked out well.
Cody's just a few feet from me right now.
And you had an extra one, which worked out well when my son accidentally broke mine a few months ago. So we worked out a trade. So yeah, Rob and I, we've known each other for a while. And, you know, I guess let's talk before we jump into the conversation about consuming baseball. I do want to talk about your most recent book, Powerball. I had the subtitle and then I just, I didn't keep it up. What is it? The Anatomy of a Modern Baseball Game. Yeah. And it's basically, I really like the concept, and it's not an original concept that you came up with. It was almost something you said, okay, it's time to do for somebody to do another book kind of this, you know, format, but with a totally different angle than the others have been. But basically you just kind of went through watching a baseball game and described the game through the 18 half innings of the game and used kind of the things that happen in each of those half innings to describe something about the modern game of baseball. Is that a fair summary?
It's an excellent summary. And yes, I will clarify one thing, which is that not only was it not an original idea, but the unoriginal idea wasn't even mine, because someone actually came to me and said, Rob, I think it's time for a modern version or an updated version of Nine Innings, a book by Dan Okrent, which I had read and which I had devoured and loved when it first was published back in, I believe that book was published in 1985. And there have been others in that vein. There's a really good book about the NBA called 48 Minutes, which does basically the same thing. So yes, there is a tradition, but no one, as far as I know, had done a book quite like this in some time, at least about baseball.
And Dan Okrent was recently a guest of yours on the Sabercast, wasn't he?
He was just a week or so ago. Yep.
Yeah. If you are interested in listening to Rob talk to, a lot of times it's baseball writers, authors, but you know, it covers a broad spectrum of baseball people. You should definitely check out Sabercast. I think my favorite episode was when you talked to Bob Kendrick from the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. Maybe it's because I love that place so much. I've only been there one time to the museum, but Bob, he sure can tell a story.
Yes, Bob is a tremendous storyteller and beloved. I mean, if you visit the museum, there's an excellent chance that you will get to meet Bob and talk to him. And, you know, to whatever degree he has the time, he will spend it talking about the museum and about Negro Leagues baseball with anyone who shows up. And he's just a wonderful person to know and to talk to. And it was really a pleasure having him on.
Yeah, between barbecue and the Negro Leagues Museum, Kansas City is definitely a place that you should visit if you ever have the opportunity. So going back to Powerball, you know, to the extent that a book can have a thesis, one centralized thesis, it seemed to me like the point of that book was, you know, to the outside eye, it looks like baseball hasn't changed much over the years. You know, the bases are still 90 feet apart. The fields look mostly the same, not quite as many weird angles as we used to have with the Polo Grounds and other stadiums that had to kind of fit into their neighborhoods. But, you know, if you went back to and watched a game from 1920, it would definitely look like baseball because a lot of things look the same. And yet baseball has changed a ton over the past 150 years. That's a fair thesis.
That's exactly right. And I think the reason that that I wanted to call it, that I call it, we call it Powerball, and that I wanted to focus on the power aspect of baseball, both on the hitting and the pitching side, is that while it's not, power in baseball is not new, you know, Babe Ruth brought the power game on the hitting side in 1919, 1920. Dazzy Vance brought, you know, you could argue that Walter Johnson had even before that, but Dazzy Vance was the first one who piled up these just phenomenal strikeout numbers in the 20s. But now we've reached a point where everybody is trying to be Babe Ruth and Dazzy Vance. Not that they all get there, but that's essentially what the goal is. If you're a young pitcher, for example, you're supposed to throw as hard as Dazzy Vance did. Well, harder, really. You're supposed to pile up the same sorts of strikeout numbers that Dazzy Vance did, or you almost disqualify yourself. And it's not quite the same with, in terms of Ruth. We don't expect every catcher or shortstop to hit 40 home runs, but we also don't see many Mario Mendozas out there for 400 at-bats in a season, right? And when that happens, they probably aren't going to last for 9 years in the major leagues. So it just, the game has become all about power, optimizing power on both sides. And I'm probably getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but what I basically wind up saying in the concluding chapter after our game is over is that we have reached a game that in many ways is less interesting than it used to be. And I'm sorry to say that we haven't seen that trend slow down at all in 2 years since I wrote the book.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's for people like you and me who love baseball, you know, we both, you can't talk to either of us and accuse either of us as not loving baseball, but we can still acknowledge that, yeah, you know, it would be more fun to watch sometimes if there was a little bit more variety in what's happening. And, you know, that we could probably spend 10 or 12 hours talking about, you know, what could be done to get things back to that place. Because the fact is, you know, the front offices are getting smarter and smarter, and a team's incentive, their job is to win as many games as possible under the existing rules. And, you know, we probably won't get too much into the outside the existing rules. I'll just briefly mention that the 2017 Astros were a key character in your book. And, you know, maybe they didn't even do everything within the existing rules, but, but team's incentive is to win. And if the incentive is to win, then you want to score as many runs as possible. And what teams have learned is that in the current environment, your best chance to score as many runs as possible is to have guys, you know, the launch angles and exit velocities and everything, which in a way is the same as it's always been. You know, Ted Williams would have said, you know, actually Ted Williams probably would have said it more modern than we might think, but any power hitter in the past would have said, just try to hit it hard and, you know, at the right, hit a hard line drive. And well, hard is exit velocity and line drive is launch angle. You know, it's the same concepts, but it's gotten so fine tuned. And really, I guess my main point is that the incentives of making an entertaining game for fans to watch are not necessarily aligned with the incentives for teams to win as much as possible.
They're not aligned at all. They are at this point, they have become diametrically opposed. And that's what makes this also, in my mind, such a stark contrast, that teams are incentivized to play less interesting baseball. And to this point, there have been these tiny little efforts to make the game more interesting, mostly by trying to speed up the game a little bit, the pace of the game. But really, and every time they come up with one of these measures, well, we'll eliminate the four balls in the intentional walk, or we will cut down a little bit on mound visits. These are all worth doing. If you can save a few seconds here and there, why not do it if you're not disrupting the game? But you're really not going to change the fundamental dynamic unless you change something fundamental. And mound visits are not fundamental.
For me, when I read, or I guess technically I listened to your book, You read that one yourself on Audible, right? You were the narrator?
Hardest thing I've ever done in my life. Yep.
I bet. I am a firm believer that baseball books should be read by the authors. And so I really enjoyed listening to that. I remember I was driving down to Dodger Stadium from my home in Utah, and I listened to your book. And I was very pleased that you narrated it yourself. But, you know, one of my takeaways was, if we can accept the fact that baseball has changed a lot, when you try to make some of these fundamental changes you're talking about, you get a lot of pushback because people say, no, the beauty of baseball is that it doesn't change. And if you right. can accept the fact that it has changed and it will continue to change, and all we're really trying to do is grab the steering wheel and have a little control over the way it changes in the future, you know, you can maybe get more on board. And I don't think, you know, personally, I'm not a big fan of rule changes. Like I'm not a fan of the three batter minimum. I think it's heavy handed because it is a new rule. And I think you could accomplish the same thing by, I actually mentioned this on this show a couple weeks ago, simply take away the pitching change exception for the mound visit rule. Mm-hmm. And that has the actual intended consequence of cutting down on mid-inning pitching changes. It's right. not so much that we care about pitching changes. It's the ones that happen in the middle of an inning. And we actually saw those go up, I think, this year because, okay, this guy got the last out of the last inning and I'll bring him in to get the first two outs. And, you know, I'll just do a mid-inning pitching change every inning. And all we did was shift by one batter how often or which three guys each reliever was pitching to, and ended up making for more mid-inning pitching changes.
Well, and they also expanded the rosters, which means almost every team simply carried one more relief pitcher. So what they should have done is limit the number of pitchers you could carry. That would have been far more effective than the three batter minimum. Look, if they'd done both, I would have been happiest with that. But adding pitchers doesn't solve the problem. It makes it worse.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a drum I've been beating for a while. I know Joe Sheehan has been beating that drum that, you know, if you – because you look at the game when I was a kid, you know, in the 80s, and there's the joke that everybody thinks the brand of baseball that was played when they were a kid is the best. And I don't even necessarily believe that, but I do think that one of the things I liked about the 1980s was it was an exception for a team to carry a sixth reliever. It was 10 pitchers on, you know, it was a 24-man roster when I was a kid, and then it went to 25. But it was always 10 pitchers and 14 or 15 position players. And, you know, I don't think we would ever get back to that extreme. But yeah, if you would put a limit and say you can only have 12 pitchers on your roster, well, then suddenly every pitcher, you can't have guys who are only facing one hitter. You have guys who know I might need to go two or three innings. So maybe I can't throw 180 miles an hour every pitch. I might have to, you know, pace myself a little bit. Starting pitchers maybe go a little bit deeper, which helps offense. And you have more hitters on the bench, pinch hitters available. You know, you just have a game that gears more towards offense and not the hit a home run kind of offense, but the get hits and get on base kind of offense.
Right. And it doesn't just help the offense. It also increases the number of decisions the manager has to make, or at least the number of interesting decisions. Because all of a sudden, if you've got a pinch extra hitter or a pinch or a running specialist, that's something that the manager has to sort through. And seeing a pinch hitter at a key moment in the game is far more interesting than seeing a, for the most part, nameless reliever. Because the relievers get shuttled in and out so quickly now that I would be, most fans of most teams would not even recognize the names of probably half a dozen or more of the pitchers who pitched for their team in the previous season. Because when you cycle in literally 15 to 20 relief pitchers over the course of 6 months, you are going to forget some of them. And which isn't nothing against those guys, those pitchers, but the fact of the matter is that if you're seeing a pitcher for a few batters, over the course of a week or two, and then he's back in AAA, you might not even ever remember him. And that's not interesting at all. It just, there are a million. Look, I happen to also think that that 80s baseball was the most interesting. And yes, maybe it's because that's when I was perhaps the most passionate about baseball. But I would start, if we wanted to figure out what that means, I would just start from first principles, make a list of what makes baseball interesting, right? And then run the study. Maybe you were wrong. Maybe the 90s, maybe the 60s were more interesting. I suspect, though, if we got together, and granted, it would be a biased list because we're interested by the things we grew up watching, but I suspect that you could come up with a fairly objective list of interesting elements. And I think that the 80s would probably tick off more boxes than any other decade, certainly more boxes than the most recent decade.
To tie this in with the Dodgers so that we've, you know, filled our mandate to talk about the Dodgers here, in this most recent World Series, some of the most exciting moments were, you know, Mookie Betts running the bases, stealing bases, getting himself, you know, getting on base with a walk and then stealing second and third and then scoring. You know, it's very old school in a way, if you quote unquote, you had the squeeze bunt, safety squeeze bunt that Austin Barnes did to score a run. And, and I don't think sacrifice bunts are interesting. And I don't, you know, there was probably too many sacrifice bunts in the 80s. And,
right.
But like you were saying, that decision, and if you can get, you know, I would rather have Mookie Betts steal second base than have somebody bunt him over to second, you know, but if he can steal second and then somebody bunts him over to third, so then he's at third with one out, well, then a lot of things can happen. And I'm less opposed to that one. And I'm definitely not opposed to a squeeze bunt. I love me a good squeeze bunt, but I think maybe the base running is the big thing that we're missing out on from the 80s, because guys just aren't on base as much. And when they are, you know, guys are walking a lot, but there's not as much incentive to run the bases if you know that the guy after you is more likely to hit a home run than to hit a single. Well, what's my incentive to be on second base? I'm going to score from first on my homer anyway.
Right. And I'll give you another example. It's been said many times that the most exciting play in baseball is the triple. And triples are way down over the last however many years. They've probably been going down forever. But I mean, there was a year, two or three years ago, I believe the Blue Jays hit like two or three triples all season. It was a ridiculously low number. And why do they stop? Well, a lot of it is that there's just, as you said, no reason to take a chance. Stop on second. The next guy's going to hit a home run maybe. Why would I go to wasting out at third base? So, you know, there are any number of things that could be done to lower the strikeout rate, to lower the home run rate, to increase the triples rate, to increase stolen bases. These aren't really difficult questions. It's the implementation that's difficult, because there's just not a critical mass of stakeholders who want to see these things. And that's where we're at right now. I think there was a brief burst of guarded optimism recently when Theo Epstein said something about, or maybe somebody just projected onto him this idea that he might wind up working for the commissioner's office and trying to make baseball a more interesting game, because he had sort of admitted that they hadn't really been incentivized to do that on the team level. But I'll believe when I see it. We always want to believe in the great man theory that, oh, Rob Manfred is the reason why the minor leagues are being contracted. Or if they could just get Theo Epstein in there, he could figure it out. No, we don't need somebody to figure it out. It's figured out, or it's figure outable. We need a huge number of people within the game to agree that these are worthwhile goals. The way to get there is not that complicated, relatively speaking.
Yeah, the key step is admitting that you have a problem. And
exactly, yes.
And you and I, you know, hopefully people who follow you or follow me know how much we love baseball. And if people like us are saying it, that, yeah, baseball is perfect, but it could be perfecter, you know?
That's right. Nothing, I don't care how much we love it. Nothing's above criticism.
Yeah.
Nothing's perfect. And baseball will never be perfect, but we can certainly work on getting closer, as opposed to just throwing up our hands and saying, well, this is as good as it can ever be. Or there are people who think that whatever baseball is in that moment is perfect, right? So maybe it's right here, up here today, and next year it's going to be down a little bit, but somehow that's still perfect. I don't know. We don't think of life in any other thing in our life that way. Why would we think of baseball that way? Baseball is, unfortunately, you know, look, it's just, it is a thing. It may be a thing that we love. It may be a thing that is better than most things, but it is still a thing and there's room for improvement.
Yeah. And it's always funny to me that it seems like a lot of times it's the older generation that is most resistant to change, you know, stop changing the game I love. And I want to say, but didn't you love it 30 years ago when games lasted 49 minutes shorter than they do now? You know, what, if it's always been perfect, wouldn't it still be perfect if we went back to the way it used to be perfect?
Right. Well, I think those people, look, they I'm sure they all have different motivations or thoughts going through their heads when they say things like that. But what they really want is for nothing to change from what it was last year. It's the dip, because most of the change in baseball has been glacial, and not always, but for the most part, it has been. So as the strikeout rate has elevated, it's been gradual year to year. So 40 years ago, you could thrive as a major league pitcher with a strikeout rate of 3 or 4 per 9 innings, right? Or a strikeout to walk ratio of 1. And now you can't thrive or even survive doing either of those things. But we got there very slowly. And most people didn't notice it while it was happening. And when they see what the numbers look like now, they say, well, that's just where we are now. Baseball is cyclical, whatever. No, we've allowed it to get to this point. Whereas in past generations, when there seemed to be an imbalance, things were done. Strike zones were changed most typically. The mound was lowered in 1969. I go into all these things in my book, but it's just the last 2 or 3 decades where the powers that be, and this is mostly because, in my opinion, the players have attained so much power that it's just so hard to change anything that MLB just sort of gave up and said, well, we're just going to see what happens. But this is a very recent phenomenon. Prior to the 1990s, baseball would do things when it looked like there were imbalances, and they just don't anymore.
Yeah, it seems like every CBA negotiation is two parties arguing over what each side wants, and there's not that third party arguing for what's actually best for the game of baseball and for the fans. And I know that's kind of cliche of me to say, but I think cliches become cliches for a reason a lot of times.
Well, no, it's absolutely true. What's also true, I think, is that if MLB comes to the players and says, we want this, MLB will use that as leverage, even if they don't care.
Yeah.
That's just basic labor negotiation. So if MLB comes and says, well, we want to drop the mound by a couple of inches, the players are going to say, you can't lower the mound. That's crazy. Well, we could talk about it if you will do this. And that's when MLB steps back and says, well, it's not really worth it to give up that just for 2 inches, you know. So, and that's sort of where, that's why I say that the players and the owners have to come together. If there's ever going to be any fundamental change, it can't be a leverage for one side or the other. They have to agree beforehand that we want to get to point A. Now, how do we get there? Let's talk about it. But you've got to agree to get there in the first place. And that hasn't happened.
Yeah, all we need is somebody like you or me to come up with a list of an even number of improvements and then assign them out. A, B, A, B, A, B. Okay, players, you care about these ones. Owners, you care about these ones.
Yep.
Now trade, and we'll get all of them.
Well, I think that's now Theo Epstein's job, right?
Hey, on this podcast, we're hashtag Jeff for commissioner. So that's okay, that will do it for today. As I mentioned at the beginning, this was the first half of my conversation with Rob. So come back tomorrow to hear the second half. And thank you for listening. If you haven't done so yet, please subscribe to Locked On Dodgers wherever you get your podcasts. If you have Apple Podcasts, go ahead and subscribe there. It helps other people find us. You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Locked On Dodgers. Vince is on Twitter at Vince Semperio. I'm on Twitter at Snydog. And Rob Nyer is on Twitter at Rob Nyer.
Our email address is lockedondodgers@gmail.com. Our phone number is 323-863-LOCK-5625. You can leave us a voicemail or shoot us a text there anytime you want. We are here every weekday morning, and we hope you'll be here with us. When you get in your car or sit on your couch, tell your smart device to play podcast Locked On Dodgers. And remember, you don't have to agree. You just have to listen. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
D. I say D-O. D-O-D-G-E-R-S. The team that's all heart, all heart and all thumbs. They're my Los Angeles. Your Los Angeles. Our Los Angeles. Do you think we'll really win the pennant? Bye!